Can't see that clock clear back there. I guess it's about 8:37, and we'll start the meeting. This is September 27th, and we have with us, we have Berta Gardner, and online is Vic Coring's staff, Jessica, and we also have Becky Rooney, my staff in Rango, and Pat Carr with Health and Social Services, and Pauline Hawker is in for Representative Hawker. And we have our presenters and people that are with us, so what I'm going to do is just start off the meeting. We are going to today cover long-term care and the Medicaid portion of our, or Medicare portion of our program, and also we will have a presentation on chronic illnesses. So we will start. Is there anyone else online that I didn't mention?
Chuck Burnham, Legislative Research in Juneau.
Oh, Chuck, yes. Chuck, thank you very much. Chuck is with Ledge Research, and he has done a lot of work for us and went through all of the long-term studies that we have gotten and kind of consolidated them for us and gave us a wonderful update. And he actually went through it and gave us kind of bullet points on every one of them and what the recommendations were. And I hope you all had a chance to go over that, because that was very interesting. And we're going to, as Jerry goes through his program, some of these programs, some of the recommendations we've already done. And so, oh, and we, Betty Davis has just joined us. Thank you for being here, Betty, Senator Betty Davis. And let's go ahead and start right in with our presentation on long-term care. And Jerry, would you, this is Jerry Fuller, and he's the director of Medicare and Medicaid. Yes, Medicaid. All right, Jerry, I'll turn it over to you and let you proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Wilson. For the record, Jerry Fuller, Medicaid Director, Department of Health and Social Services, Alaska. I intend to talk rather informally for about 15, maybe 20 minutes. I don't want to be too long-winded and leave a lot of time for questions. Ahead of the time, you should have received or had access to the executive summary from a report done by the Lewin Group on the cost of the Medicaid program in the long run, and an executive summary from Public Consulting Group, another study that we commissioned to look at recommendations, actions we might take to improve the long-term care system. And then finally, you have a one-page quote. And I was going to end with a quote, but I think I'll start with a quote at this point. If you looked at it, it talks about the challenges facing Medicaid financing, new flexibilities under the federal laws and regulations, and the challenges facing states in terms of sustainability, quality, and you know, meeting the needs of the people. I put that quote in there because I thought it was relevant. It pretty much encapsulates what's going on today. However, it was written in 1981. And I have the complete book if anyone is up for torture, but it was New Approaches to the Medicaid Crisis. So, you know, 25, 26 years later, we're still facing similar issues, similar challenges, but different. So, anyway, just to set the context. First of all, I'd like to, yes. First of all, I'd like to thank this committee for your support of the Medicaid program and the long-term care system. This system, as it is, supports the most vulnerable, most needy citizens, our relatives, our neighbors' relatives, our neighbors, people that we live and work with every day. So start out by thank you. This system that we have has evolved over many, many years. The original Medicaid program only provided for nursing home services. And over time, it became its industry, an industry unto itself. And in the early 80s, mostly through the efforts of a couple of states, waivers were developed to permit folks to choose long-term care services within the community, within their own home. Alaska got on board the waiver alternative in the mid-90s and developed four different waivers, and as a result has been able to restrain the growth of nursing home beds in the state. The number of beds has been almost constant, very little growth since the development of the waivers. And in terms of cost, nursing home beds, the day rates are much, much higher than maintaining someone in their own home or someone in a community setting. And for the most part, the consumers of these services prefer to remain in their own home as long as possible or in their own community and not end up in a nursing home someplace, usually not in their community. So we should appreciate your support. The state of Alaska has done a lot to get where we're at, and of course it's a never-ending struggle. The Lewin report showed quite clearly that the growth in the services, the Medicaid services for our elderly and disabled population is going to about quadruple in the next 20 years or so. And this is a nationwide issue. It's not unique to Alaska. Anytime you look at the paper almost, it's talking about Medicaid issues. And so we're not unique, but we do have to deal with the problem. Now, we could just assume that the federal government will assume the long-term care costs at some point, much like they've done with the drug costs for the senior population. Former HHS Secretary Tommy Thompson, upon his retirement from HHS, came out recently with a proposal that suggested that the federal government should take over the long-term care system. But the state of Alaska and the other states cannot assume that that's going to happen anytime soon. So we need to adjust our own system as best we can to make it as sustainable as possible in the long run. Now, when I say sustainable, I don't use the words we're going to save costs. We can reduce costs, but the demographics of the elderly population, particularly in Alaska, it's the most rapidly growing group across the whole country, 2% increase a year or something like that. So the demographics are pushing the cost of the long-term care system, the need for the long-term care system. The baby boomers, radio, NPR this morning said the first one's turning 60, and most communities, no states have prepared themselves for the onslaught of the services and needs, not just health care, but across the board for this population. In addition, the proportion or the number of people over 85 is increasing rapidly. If you look at our nursing home population and probably also the pioneer homes, the typical resident is over 85, frail, and female. That's pretty much the profile, and it's only going to increase over time. Adding to this is the fact that employers are dropping insurance or the benefits are becoming reduced so that as people retire, there's less availability of the employer-sponsored insurance to cover the other medical needs of these folks. And a little bit later, you will hear from Tammy about chronic diseases and how I think you'll hear about how diabetes and heart disease and others are just increasing rapidly, and all of that drives up the cost for this population. So there's a multitude of drivers of this issue, and we really don't have a lot of control over the aging population. The Lewin report assumed for its projections, the same program, no significant policy changes throughout the 2025-year projection. But there is something brewing already that may change that, and that's the issue of Medicare coverage for retired folks. It's been in the newspaper several times that fewer and fewer physicians are accepting Medicare. Medicare is the primary payer, so when Medicare, if they can't find a Medicare doctor, the secondary payer, whether it's state employment, retirees insurance, or private insurance, won't pay either. So these folks that can't find a doctor that will take Medicare are paying cash to get to see a physician or a practitioner. If that trend continues, you might assume, logically, that some of these folks are going to say enough is enough and move someplace else where they can get access to the Medicare benefits that basically they've contributed to all of their life. And so some factor like that may change the demographic of the Alaska's aging population, but it's too soon and to project, and we don't know what's going to really happen there. We hope for a fix on the Medicare side.
Yeah, Jerry, just a second. Before we go further, I have neglected to say who is in the audience, and we have our commissioner, Carlene Jackson, with us, and we have Sherry Hill, and we have Stephanie Birch, and with those are the ones that are with the department, and we also have some other. Charlie Miller is back there, and I think I got everybody, and then. Tammy's going to present. And also online, we Katie in Seaton's office has joined us. So thank you for listening in. If you have any questions, anybody that's online, don't hesitate to just kind of interrupt us, and hopefully we will we'll be able to tell our names before. There's not too many of us are here, so that hopefully you will be able to recognize who is talking, and I will try to make sure that I make a comment. And Representative Gardner had a question?
Yeah, I do have a question, and I'm not sure if you're the person who can answer this, but I've been hearing from a lot of constituents who are having exactly that problem, trying to get get a doctor to see them, and fewer doctors are accepting, or they've drawn the line on Medicare patients because the reimbursement rates are so much below the standard. And as I see it, one of the problems is that if somebody has other insurance in addition, that insurance is prohibited or refuses to cover the gap. And it seems to me that if we had a system where other insurance would cover what the physician can't get from Medicare, that we might address the problem in some way there.
Yeah, so I really am not the right person to address that, but you're absolutely correct, as I said, that Medicare is the primary payer, and if you have a Medigap policy, whether it's private pay or through your employer, it doesn't pay until Medicare does their piece first. At least that's my understanding of it, but I'm no Medicare expert, so I'll be the first to acknowledge that. John, please.
This is John Sherwood with the Department of Health and Social Service. I think there is law that's relatively recent, it's federal law that prohibits or actually requires physicians, if they're going to accept Medicare, to accept Medicare payment, the Medicare rates for payment. And I'm not the expert either. My understanding, and we'll try and confirm this, is that unless you take just a very small percentage of Medicare clients, you're required to accept the Medicare rate, so you cannot charge the your patient or an insurance company an additional rate. I know, actually, just before this meeting, I was going over my mother's statement with her, and that was certainly what her statement implied in looking at the billings. And in a typical example would be. The physician might charge $100, the Medicare rate would be $46, part of that would be paid by Medicare, and then part of it would be my mother's copayment. So most of the bills I looked at were anywhere, Medicare paid anywhere from about a high of about 60% to down to about 30% of what that charge was. So that, I don't know how typical that is, but that's just what I was seeing this morning.
So it's not surprising that physicians aren't willing to take Medicare patients if everyone costs them.
I would like to also make a comment that Representative Sisna has joined us. And Senator Davis, you had a question?
Yes, I do. Just to follow up on the question that was asked, Both of you said that you didn't have any information to share about what's happened with the Medicare patients here in our states. I want to know what's different about what we do compared to what they are doing in other states. Say California, for instance. I had a lady that was in my office not too long ago, and I got calls from other people that said they came from other states, and they are being covered. But when they come here, because of the way our system is, they are not able to get doctors, private doctors, to take them on. Now, I understand that you have to agree to accept the Medicare rate if you do take those patients in, but what's different about our system than some of the other states that would allow seniors to be able to use their primary insurance before they use Medicare if necessary?
Well, the difference I'm aware of is just the charges for the health care services in other states. Generally, those charges are closer to what Medicare pays, and practitioners are more able to accept that. Not all practitioners and not everywhere, but generally it's more accessible. Alaska's high cost of everything appears to be driving the gap between what Medicare will reimburse and the usual and customary charges.
It seems to be a little bit more than that because there are doctors that are telling people that even though they've had them on their caseload for a while, they tell them that they can no longer take them because if they don't accept the Medicare, then they cannot have those patients' private insurance to pay.
Correct.
And that's strictly because it's something that we say has to take place.
The change that occurred January 1 was a reduction in Medicare reimbursement. As I understand it, there was about a two-year adjustment upwards in Medicare that expired in January, and that dropped the Medicare reimbursement. So that's why it, I believe, is hitting like a wave at this point. Our delegation is, you know, trying to work on it. I don't know, you know, with everything else that's going on, how successful they may be, but they're definitely aware of it.
If I understand you right, then it's not just in Alaska that's happening. It's happening, I mean, it's all over, but because the costs are so much higher in Alaska, a lot of our doctors are just saying we're not even going to accept Medicaid patients. Is that what you're saying?
That appears to be what's occurring.
Is there, and of course, I know this is a federal thing, but is there any way that we can say, I'm just trying to think how we can deal with this because this is just a start. We're just starting into this where there's going to be so many more people coming online every year. I mean, in the whole United States it's happening, but obviously it's really happening in Alaska for the first time. We're going to see a total change about in the next 10 years of where the majority of the people are in age. And so if they're not even dealing with it now when it's just starting, I can't see that it's going to get much better.
Well, the delegation is working on it. Whether, when and how they'll be successful, you know, remains to be seen. But I brought this point up because if it isn't corrected over time, it will change the demographics of Alaska in that the logical person will head south where they can get health care. So the Lewin report is based on a status quo, and I just use that as one example to indicate that things change. Theirs was an estimate, a projection, a very long-term projection, and factors like this may make it somewhat moot.
Chair, do you think it would help at all if we had a letter from the committee?
To the delegation?
Yes.
I would think that it wouldn't hurt.
Okay, I think maybe we should discuss that later. Representative
Sisna. Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that I was in D.C. about 3 years ago, and 3 years ago, and in talking with Senator Stevens' staff, they were lamenting that they had not gotten really what they felt was a sufficient amount of feedback from Alaska and enough support for the fact that they had been able to achieve that increase in Medicaid payments to practitioners. And And I know that I also, just as Senator Davis has had, have had constituents concerned about this issue of access to doctors sort of nonstop. And I'm kind of wondering how can we make this a more high-profile issue? Because I think one of the problems is that if the congressional offices aren't really hearing back, and that's what they were saying, it wouldn't necessarily just be this committee. It would be people actually recognizing that they even played a part, that there was anything happening at all. I think people didn't realize that it was being supplemented above what we would have normally gotten under the normal conditions. And the loss of that must have meant a real increase in the problem that may not even be realized yet, because it's only when people access their health care that they notice that there's a difference in cost. You don't notice it if you're not needing it. So I'm just wondering, how can we maybe keep track of the problem, really start focusing on the problem, and really maybe making regular reports so that maybe the general public even knows what's going on and can react, because the congressional office isn't going to get anything from Alaska unless people out there know what's going on, you know?
Good point. We'll have to think about that. Yeah. Jerry, why don't you go ahead?
So anyway, the overall demographic is driving the Lewin projection at this point, inflation, increased aging, et cetera. And within the PCG report and many of the previous reports, there are recommendations on reconfiguring, changing our system to better to be able to sustain the system long term. I don't want to go into detail, but we'll try to entertain questions about detail if you wish. But one of the primary areas is the entry into the long-term care system. Within several of the reports, and then also in recent testimony to Congress by Governor Nalapano, I think it is, from Arizona, soon to be chair of National Governors Association, her words were, in terms of Arizona, that they have a vigorous medical eligibility pool. Translation, they have a very rigorous objective screening of individuals before they determine that, yes, they do require nursing home level of care, and that's the gateway into the waiver system. Alaska needs to improve that, I think. It's sort of the basic step that you would make, that if people are not needing the level of services to require nursing home, then they're really not eligible, and we need to enforce that better. Throughout all of this, too, I want to make this point right now. The primary source of long-term care in Alaska and this country is the daughter and the daughter-in-law. It's the family. And any system changes that we make, we don't want to disrupt that. We want to find ways to support that, whether it's a different service or what, I don't know, but we need to recognize that while the Medicaid cost for long-term care is increasing rapidly, we still have this huge unpaid pool out there, the relatives, that the unsung heroes, if you will. And whatever changes we want to make in the future to make it sustainable, we don't want to disrupt that. We want to support that as best we can.
Jerry, I'm thinking, too, if the daughter and daughter-in-law, many times they have jobs, that they're working jobs, and then when they get off their job, they go immediately over to a relative and start working, more hours. So I think that there would be a real big chance of burnout, and these people are getting older, and so their care is getting harder. I mean, as we get older, we have more problems. So Representative Gardner.
One of the concerns I've heard, and I have a couple of friends who run businesses that help provide these waiver services, and what they hear is that the people who are doing it for family members are now paid by the state. that's one of the reasons there's a big leap in the cost is not necessarily more services, but more people being paid for services who were doing it before. And so something's wrong with our kind of approach in that way. And one agency I know no longer handles, will deal with personal care attendants. They gave the story of the woman whose hours were cut, and she stormed, got in her car and drove over and stormed into the office to complain about the cut in her personal care services. So it definitely needs to be tightened up.
We will be the first to acknowledge that the system is not perfect. It will never be perfect, but all we can do is strive to make improvements. So, message heard.
Yes, thank you. I guess one of the things that I have noticed just in going to communities is the kind of the demographic shift in Alaska. Used to be that the minute that your family started, you know, your parents started having problems, you moved outside. That we used to leave the state to go take care of our family. And more people are deciding to stay here. They're deciding to stay here in their own retirement. But they're also deciding to bring their family members up here. And at the very same time, what we also have been shown in this committee numerous times is the demographics of the employed Alaskans, and that more and more it's on the older side of the curve that we have people filling a lot of really important responsible jobs, and that we have that gap in the kind of younger middle age that are not in the state. So we have, it seems to me, a possibility, and I don't know that I've heard of any studies about this, that if, in fact, we change our policies enough, you're going to have a decrease in those middle-aged people who are bringing their families up because they're going to be going out with that family member. And so it's really important to look at who's doing what and how is it going to affect the economy. And I don't know that I've heard of that being studied.
And I have no information to be able to respond to you. I would agree that it's probably quite true. If you look across the country, just in terms of employment, the next 5 years is going to be a huge retirement boom across the country, myself included. And there's much fewer younger people moving along with the expertise or even the desire to pick up some of these rather important jobs. And it's all part of the baby boom. You look at how Social Security is structured, and when it started out, it was 40 or 50 workers for supporting each person that was retired back when it was a farm economy. And I think it's estimated to be down to 2 or 3 workers supporting each Social Security beneficiary before very long. So it's the whole aging dynamic, if you will. It's contributing to the sustainability of the long-term care system.
And, you know, I want to make a comment here because I believe that we might be the only state that when we lose people, as far especially elderly people, in this state, they don't pay taxes, you know, and even at the local level, they don't have to pay taxes because of the 65-year-old, they don't pay any property taxes. So other states, they have to, but here in Alaska, they don't, and they don't pay any state income tax or any state sales tax. So the state doesn't get any money for any of these people that are older, and we're all on the edge of this. And so what happens is that the more people that come up here, the harder it is on the state to provide services because we don't get any more money when they come. You know, at the local level, they might be buying groceries and things like that and spending some of their money, but the state doesn't get anything for them. And so we have to keep providing more and more and more because of the changing of our demographics, but we're not getting any more income. And that's a fact that we have to realize that that isn't happening. If they go back to the lower 48, they're going to end up paying taxes. And so when any state gets more population, the state gets more money to pay for that, those services. And so Alaska, we don't have that. And I don't know, I don't think we can sustain that. But Jerry, go ahead and it's just something, it's a fact that we have to live with and deal with. Representative Sisson?
Well, there's another side to that, and that's one of the problems that we have in Alaska is there's kind of, and this is my own personal view, is that we do have a separation between what's good for the state government and what's good for the local economy, because what's good for the state government is really for nobody to come to Alaska at all, because the more people come because of the dividend, the more there is pressure on the state. We don't really have a way, as the chair has mentioned, to capture money as a state. But what all of these smaller communities, and it's only been 42 that I've gone to so far to sort of ask some of these questions, what they're talking about is the more the philanthropical relationship of seniors to the community, and that in fact in small communities it's the retired population, the elderly, that are the ones that are doing all of the volunteer work for the non-paid positions in the community, the people who go out and get the grant and fund the EMS, the library, the museum, the whatever is in communities, is according to like all the small town mayors and local officials, those are the people that they rely on for the extras, the things that the state no longer does come through with. It's the seniors, because they're the ones who aren't working two or three jobs. They're the ones that still have money. They bring money with them from somewhere else, and they pay for instance, the hairdresser. They're the ones that keep the grocery store still in business, because they actually pay money for what they get there, and they're less likely to drive up to Anchorage or fly to Anchorage to fill up at Costco. They're the ones with real money in the community, and the ones that are really still allowing the doctor to stay. They're the ones that are really creating the ability for small communities not to go under. That's what the local people have been telling me. And until we actually get that, now maybe they're just telling me something that isn't actually true. I think we need to know. I think it's really important to figure that out, because if what I've been told is true, we better know that, because it's going to have a huge impact. And our job is not just to keep the state okay, but to build the local economy.
And you know, these are things that we need to think about, because we need to have maybe toward the end an added meeting on, so that we start to really look at some of those things, because no matter what we do, we might not be able to see a difference because of the demographics that will be changing, and we don't have any control of that. But I think we better get going, because we do have another presentation. So, Jerry, go ahead.
I'll move right along quickly. In addition to improvements in the entry system into the long-term care, there's many recommendations in the PCG report and some of the previous reports about the service array. We need to modify and improve the service array to better serve these folks. Now, the one that quickly comes to mind is making use of technology. You may have seen the things on the Discovery Channel or whatever, of homes set up with cameras and sensors. And, you know, if an elderly person is in their own home where it's wired, if you will, with someone on the other end paying attention, Well, that's reasonably low cost of care compared to a nursing home bed or even assisted living. So we need to modify appropriately the service array to best support people in their own homes, to keep them there as long as reasonably and financially practical, make sure that the assisted living array of services is appropriate, to best keep people out of nursing homes. So we need to do all of those things. I'm not going to go through any of these reports about the specifics because there's numerous things. But I will mention that if someone took the PCG report and said, go do this, well, it's impossible. We need to transition over probably 3 to 5 years in order to reach this end goal of the most sustainable system we can put together. We need to be thoughtful about it and try not to let a budget crisis drive radical reductions, if you will. So now's the time to be figuring out what is it we need to do while the budget is solid, not when it tanks on us.
Well, and actually, Jerry, I just talked with the finance chairman yesterday, and already we're looking at next year we'll probably be cutting if things don't get better. And so, you know, I think it's very important. I think that's one reason why this committee is doing this, so that we can say, you know what, that sounds good, but we have done some studying and we've done some research on this, and that is not going to help matters. It's actually going to make it worse in the long run. We really need to step up and know what the ramifications of these changes are. We're going to have to really do some work yet before this is all over.
That's a good segue into something I didn't know quite how to fit into this. In the healthcare system, you can cut services whether you're on the private market or the public market, but if someone is sick, they will get services, usually in the highest cost setting, the emergency room. So the unintended consequences needs to always be carefully looked at. I guess a previous administration used the balloon where you squeeze the balloon and it pops out someplace else. You can consider hydraulics. You put pressure on the fluid here and something's going to move over there. Or John's favorite one is the carnival game of whack the mole. You whack it when it pops up out of the hole and you don't know where it's going to pop up again. But you have to be as thoughtful as possible because the unintended consequences can cost you more in the short run and the long run. So thanks for that segue. That was great. In addition to whatever changes, the quality assurance system really has to be modified, improved to go along with whatever our new system is going to look like. More and more, as I said earlier, the demographics over 85, probably not many relatives around to check up on them in the nursing home, in the assisted living, or in their own home. There needs to be a really decent QA structure to make sure that people are safe, that they're not being taken advantage of by their caregivers or by relatives that might be around. We read those stories in the newspaper every so often, and to the degree we can find methods and ways to prevent that, we really need to also tweak or make major changes perhaps to the QA system. Now, and again, the transition, that's really important. If we have to make swift cuts the next session, well, we'll have to deal with it. But if we haven't the leisure to plan this out over several years, when 2025 comes along, we should be in much better shape than if we have to make sudden, abrupt changes. One aspect that I want to focus on a little bit is the tribal healthcare system in Alaska. When the tribal healthcare system provides services to an American Indian Alaska Native, that's funded 100% federal funds. And so, you know, there's six hospitals and I don't know how many practitioners, but the tribal system is only beginning to look at the long-term care system as a service array that they might be able to provide to their members. Norton Sound Hospital has swing bed nursing home. YK, Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation, is looking at some swing beds and assisted living. And that's one area where if we can work closely with the tribal health corporations to support them in their their desire or their directions for expanding long-term care services for their members. They win and the state wins. We save general fund. They're better able to serve their members, hopefully closer to home, hopefully in more culturally appropriate settings. So I don't want to lose sight that that is out there. The tribes are strapped because federal funding is pretty much flat, so they have their own financial issues to deal with to meet the needs of their members. And a couple other areas here. The Deficit Reduction Act that was passed early this year has some provisions in it to assist states in helping middle-class Americans not spend down their assets to become eligible or hide their assets to become eligible for Medicaid. But along with that, they've opened up the possibility of what are called long-term care partnerships. Folks that can afford long-term care insurance can actually use that in this partnership plan to shelter an equal amount of assets compared to the benefit of the insurance that they have. And there's been four states that have had this for a number of years. And while the savings aren't great, just a few million, the middle-class folks that get this insurance and use it generally stay out of Medicaid and never enter the system. A few do, but not a great number.
Jerry, what are the four states?
Explain that a little bit, too. Do you know what the four states are?
Well, the four states, it was Connecticut, help me out, John, was it California?
Indiana,
yeah.
One of them. I think it's California. And was it South Dakota, or are they...
Four states did this, but then a law was passed by the feds that precluded any other states from doing it. But the Deficit Reduction Act that just passed now opens this up to all states.
Okay. What happens to that money that they set aside? Where does it go? How does it get used?
Well, it's help you understand, if you qualify for Medicaid to pay for your long-term care, you're subject to, you have to meet financial eligibility criteria.
And excuse me, but by the way, this is John Sherwood speaking.
Thank you. Any money we would spend on long-term care is subject to estate recovery. When you die, we can recover against your estate, make a claim against your estate for that money. If somebody buys a long-term care insurance policy under this this partnership, the benefits that that policy pays toward their long-term care, they get a dollar-for-dollar credit when they're applying for Medicaid. It reduces the amount of assets we would count when we look at their bank accounts or stocks or whatever. If they're in a nursing home or on a waiver or receiving home community-based services and applying for Medicaid, the long-term care insurance is paid $100,000 in benefits. We will disregard $100,000 of their assets in determining them eligible for Medicaid, and when they die, we will disregard that $100,000 of their assets from our estate recovery. So individuals who worry about having to become impoverished to qualify for Medicaid, not being able to leave an inheritance to their children or other dependents, can buy one of these partnership insurance, have the protection that it will provide if it proves to be inadequate, because most of these policies have some kind of limit. Medicaid can still come in and assist and pay, but they have protected their assets as they intended to through the purchase of the policy.
Now, if they need to use those assets, are they frozen then so that they can't touch that amount? Or
no, they can do whatever they want with those assets. It's just a disregard that we would not count them when they applied, upon their death, we would really use those benefits to reduce our claim against the estate. So we would have a much smaller claim against the estate. So, and even the states that did this before 1993, since most people buy long-term care insurance in their mid-40s to early 60s, those states are just beginning to see savings because the relatively small numbers of people who bought these insurance are actually using long-term care yet. It's still uncertain how much states will save in the long run. It certainly is a way to encourage the middle class to take more responsibility for providing for their long-term care and still provide them some backup protection through the Medicaid system, which in most of the states that don't have this partnership is really the default for long-term care. If people can't afford it out of their own assets, they will find a way onto the Medicaid program.
Chuck, are you still on?
Yes.
That maybe would be something good that we need to look into. Can you do some searching for us on that?
Yes, I can.
Okay, that'd be great. Thank you.
This is Jerry Fuller again. A second possibility for folks with estates with assets is reverse mortgages. You've read about those in the paper, where basically the bank gives them the money. To promote that, though, if you look at the details, those are very high cost loans. Banks don't just do this lightly. If I were to look at something like this, I would sell my home and use the assets for whatever I need rather than this reverse mortgage approach. But it might have some attraction for some folks that have their own home. So it's another small possibility to beef that up, to make it more consistent, probably governed by the insurance division, so that people are more willing to use that approach. And then I have this other general other incentives, and this is where I'll get fired. But we have the permanent fund distribution, and folks get it, and then they need long-term care, and the state picks up the total bill. Well, it goes back a bit to what was discussed earlier, that there's no taxes on folks. They can earn their money and spend it how they want and then look to the state to take care of them. And I know it's a politically suicidal message, but it's one that at some point needs to be addressed. What other incentives could the state put in place for folks to maybe use their PFD with a state supplement to buy long-term care insurance? There's got to be some way to figure out other incentives for those that can afford it to get involved in long-term care. And bottom line, it's a personal responsibility again. That's the theme that we need to make throughout any long-term care discussion, that Alaskans or Michiganders or any other place, you have to be responsible for yourself as best you can. And that's where it gets into some folks throughout their life will never be able to save or to acquire assets to take care of themselves in old age. That's where Medicaid should come in and step up to take care of those folks. The other population, we need to assist them. We need to educate them that you can't count on the government to take care of you necessarily. It's like folks who think that Social Security is going to take care of them in their old age, and then when they get their first check, they realize they've made a huge mistake. And so in terms of personal responsibility, there's this old quote that I have to say. If I knew I was going to live so long, I would have taken better care of myself. And that's where it gets into chronic disease management that will be coming along here very soon. Other issues, workforce. All across the country, the workforce will be an issue in that there's fewer younger people available just in terms of numbers to take care of us rapidly growing older population. So where are we going to get folks to provide the personal care or the nursing assistance or whatever it might be? And again, it's a nationwide issue that doesn't have any simple answer for Alaska.
Robots.
Well, in a teasing sort of way, we thought about, the cruise ships. for the price we pay for some assisted living, you could probably rent or buy a few cruise ships. They have physicians and staff on board, full care, full service, and would probably be cheaper than some of the other models that we've looked at. So just anchor a few cruise ships. And QA, again, that's going to be critical in whatever we do to make sure that these folks are safe, getting their needs met and not being taken advantage of. So I think that's more than enough for today.
Thank you very much, Jerry. Any questions?
Little pearl spot.
It's really kind of scary when you think about it, because I'm a nurse, and I realize the situation in the hospitals right now. Even in Wrangell, I talked to the hospital administrator a couple days ago, and he said that they have 3 travel nurses right now. 3. And he says it's just killing them, you know, because they have to pay so much more. They had to provide their housing. They had to provide their food. They had to provide their laundry services. I mean, it's amazing what they're trying to provide so that they can get them to come. And if that's happening now, before we get to the peak of the change, what are we going to do? Because it's going to be nationwide, and there will not be enough. Now, what do they do? Do they shut down long-term care places because they don't have enough nurses and nurses' aides to take care of them? I mean, what are people going to do?
You have to be really nice to your children now.
I guess that's one of the answers, that's for sure. Okay, well, thank you very much, Jerry. And, John, do you have any comments that you want to add to this?
No, I think Jerry covered it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
And we look forward to continuing the discussion. This is only the shot across the bow, if you will.
Right. And I hope that everyone did get a chance to look at the legislative research report that Chuck Burnham did, and on page 5 of 29, it really, I actually went through and went to the year 1999A on that chart, and went back and looked at all the recommendations, and so there were recommendations quite some time ago, and Jerry, is there any way, or maybe the department or someone can go through these and tell me which ones we've already done? Because there's a lot of recommendations of what to do in administration, in service delivery, in finances, in assessment tools, and the waiver programs. But I don't know which ones we've already done and put in place and which ones we didn't.
Well, we could probably do that, maybe not at a real detail level, but maybe with qualifiers that we did it this way or something like that.
Okay.
It'll probably take a bit of time, but I think we should be able to do that. It would help us in determine our base of where we are.
Right, and I think we need to know that as the committee as a whole needed to know that before we get, before we can actually decide which direction what are the possibilities now, you know. So I would appreciate that if somebody can get that done somehow. Okay, now we are going to go into chronic care and chronic disease and prevention and health promotion. And Tammy Green has that for us. So Tammy, we'll let you go ahead. And then as you go along, I'll just encourage anyone, if they have questions, to make a comment. Because I think if we can make the comments as we go along, it's easier for us.
Sure. Thank you. This is Tammy Green. I'm the Section Chief for Chronic Disease Prevention and Health Promotion with the Division of Public Health within our Department of Health and Social Services. And for those of you online, I am assuming that you have a copy of my PowerPoint presentation, and I'll try to cue you as I move through the slides, but wanted to do an overview and appreciate the opportunity to come and speak to you today about chronic disease. And as Jerry mentioned, chronic disease is really impacting our healthcare system in multiple ways. And I want to give you just an overview of what it looks like in Alaska and some of the things that are happening within our section that we're trying to do to address the issues. Now, if I can work a little mouse. So the first slide, for those of you online, says chronic disease in Alaska. And what I wanted to do today was just to give you a scope, a real overview of the scope of the problem, how we got here and how we are addressing this. Now, keep in mind, this is not the end-all, everything that we're doing or there is around chronic disease, but it will give you kind of an opportunity to see what's happening. We want to look at the scope of the problem in terms of deaths, quality of life, and disability, and the economic burden. That's one way to kind of look at how chronic disease impacts our society. If you look at this first slide, and I'm sorry, those of you online, I think I'm on slide number 3 now. It says number of deaths due to the top 7 chronic diseases in Alaska. If you look at the deaths in Alaska in 2004, 58% of all deaths were related to chronic disease. And cancer is our top killer in cause of death in our state. And up until about a year ago, we were the only state that cancer was the number one cause of death other than, and nationally it's heart disease, but now there are about 3 other states that cancer is also the number one cause of death. So it just gives you a really quick view of the impact of chronic disease in our state. Not only does chronic disease cause death, but one of the things I think we really need to look at is the long-term impact, and Jerry was also talking about this in terms of long-term care. Chronic diseases, due to their nature, chronic long-term, have an impact on people's lives that really go beyond just, you know, folks dying from it. This slide just gives you an idea of how many productive years of life were lost in Alaska in 2004 due to deaths from the top 7 diseases that we just looked at. So 8,630 years of productive life were lost. That's a huge amount of time in terms of what people could do or what they might have done. Alaskans who die from cancer lose an average of 4.5 years of productive life. And Alaskans who die from diabetes lose an average of 7.1 years of productive life. Those, particularly the last one, diabetes, if you look at that, that is a disease that we're really starting to see increasing quite rapidly. It not only affects the loss of life in terms of what people can and can't do, but it really impacts their daily life. So 46% of diabetic Alaskans report activities limited due to a health problem. This is like during a month period of time. 39% of Alaskans with hypertension report activities limited due to the health problems. So those give you an example, again, of how much how many limitations are imposed on people who have chronic diseases.
Tammy, just looking at that slide right there, my husband has... He's a diabetic, he has hypertension, and also high cholesterol. So, the trio,
yeah,
you know. And so, you know, and he's actively working, you know, and things like that. But, you know, if people don't take care of those things,
right,
those are areas that we, you know, that a lot of people that are now working, doing well, and that it's controlled, if they don't continue taking their meds and doing what they're supposed to do and exercising, we will see a lot of areas where they're going to end up in trouble later on.
Absolutely, and I appreciate that comment because I think that's one of the things that we really have to help people understand is once you are diagnosed and have some of these different chronic diseases, there are lots of opportunities for people to do self-care and to make choices that can really enhance their health and also their productivity as well as living a normal, healthy life. I just wanted to take a break and see if anybody online had any questions or if every, you know, if anybody wondered where we're at.
Or Representative Sisson?
Well, unless somebody online jumps in. My question would be there are other states now that are that have come in, as you say, as leading in cancer being the cause of death. And my question would be, is there a per capita percentage or any way for us to compare how much more or less Alaskans are at risk compared to those states? Do we still lead or kind of what?
We could look at that. You know, we've kind of clumped all of the different types of cancer together, so we could look at different risk factors. For example, I'll show you in a few minutes. One of our major risk factors here is smoking. You know, and that's lung cancer is our top cause of cancer death. So, in some ways, we can look at that and see real clearly where we are compared to the rest of the U.S.
And I want to make a comment here, too, Tammy, because it makes a difference what the doctors tell the patients. And I think sometimes we have doctors that don't really go into just a for instance, and I use my husband again here, he has changed doctors. And the doctor that he had before always said, oh, you're doing fine. And it was hard for me, because I'm a nurse, you know, it's hard for me to sit back because I thought, you know, you need to be exercising a little more and things like that. Well, now he's changed doctors, and all at once this doctor is saying, hey, you've got to really, you know, do all these things. And so it really makes a difference. Some doctors really don't push it like they need to make these people realize that there's, this could be serious down the line if you don't start taking these steps now.
And that's one of the things we'll talk a little bit about in a second with disease management and self-management. A lot of physicians, you know, they're so busy, they don't have a huge amount of time to spend with their patients. And for a lot of physicians, they may not have been trained in any kind of lifestyle or, you know, preventive medicine or nutrition or anything like that. I think we just assume because they're doctors that, you know, they know everything and that they're going to be able to do that. And you're right, for particularly for older people that really look to their doctors for really what the answer is, those physicians have an opportunity to really educate their patients and really help them understand the role that they have in helping themselves to become healthier and to live, you know, fuller lives. So I think we have and that's one of the things that we want to do is to try to work more with providers to help them understand the importance of, you know, educating their patients about lifestyle choices. The next one is just, did you have a question, Betty?
Oh, no.
No, it's okay. This is just, I think, an interesting slide. It looks at how chronic disease reduces the quality of life. Diabetic Alaskans report 12 poor health days a month. That's almost half of the month that they're saying that they're limited because they have poor health. And another one is arthritis, and about seven, they report about 7 days of poor health per month. So when you start to look at that, the other thing about chronic disease is that often it's not just that you have one chronic disease, but a lot of times people have multiple chronic diseases. So that really gives you this synergistic impact on your health. So again, we want to try to help increase that for Alaskans. And then the final part of looking at the scope of the problem is the economic burden. And I know all of you have seen multiple ways of cutting the pie to look at the health care costs. But I think this just, in my mind, in a real one slide really shows you, you know, for 75% of our health costs in the United States is related directly to chronic disease. Heart disease and stroke at the top with $352 billion, obesity $117 billion, cancer $172, diabetes $98, and arthritis $82. So, again, it gives you an idea, which I know that all of you are fully aware of the cost, but we, as Jerry said, we can't continue. We've got to figure out how we can get around this. And I think the really interesting thing is we've also reached this time and space where we have all this technology, all these drugs, all these kinds of high-tech ways to treat things, which are wonderful, but for a large portion of what's happening to our population, there's some simple things that we need to help our population engage in, and that is making healthier lifestyle choices.
Thank you, Representative Gardner.
So those figures, $352 billion, over what period of time?
A year.
Whoa.
Yes. Huge part of our economic driving force. And as Jerry mentioned, you know, businesses are starting to be really saddled with all of these health care costs because their insurance costs keep going up. And I'll talk about a couple things we're doing in that arena in just a few minutes. Any other questions to this? Anything from those online? Okay. The next slide is how we got here. And really, if you look at chronic diseases, there's about three major risk factors that really form the foundation of chronic disease, and that is tobacco use, inactivity, overweight, and obesity. If we could eliminate those things or get folks engaging in healthier behaviors, we would be well on our way to a healthier society.
Representative Sisson and then Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Well, when I was diagnosed with cancer, what I was told was the number one risk factor actually is aging, and that we have an aging population in Alaska suddenly. What part does that maybe play?
Well, you know, that is a great, I'm glad you mentioned that. Of course, that is, you know, underlying things. As we get older, we're definitely going to be, you know, more at risk for things. But these types of activities or choices really speed that process up and cause that aging process to be accelerated and also to maybe come into play a little bit earlier.
Representative Gardner?
Alcohol isn't in here?
You know, alcohol is obviously a problem, particularly in our state, but in terms of direct association with chronic diseases, it's not as directly associated as these three major risk factors are.
Is alcohol, that's not considered in the chronic disease area, even though it's a chronic problem?
Yeah, and we've had lots of discussion about how that, you know, we try to link more with folks because we obviously know that one of the things that that we just know is that folks who engage in some of these different risk behaviors, again, like chronic diseases, they're multifaceted. You're usually not just drinking alcohol. Those folks who are alcoholics or heavy alcohol users most likely are also tobacco users, and they, because of not being healthy, they're probably not very physically active, and they may be overweight. You know, so all of those things kind of roll into each other, and we do try to make an effort to partner with those folks who are doing working with alcohol and keeping that in mind. I wanted to show you just a few slides of some data that what we look like in Alaska. This is adolescent smoking because we said that tobacco is a major risk factor. In 1995, our rates in Alaska, and you can see Alaska is red and the U.S. is yellow, for smoking for adolescents was 37% in Alaska and 35% in the U.S. And in 2003, we saw a terrific nice downward trend in our adolescent smoking. It dropped to 19% in Alaska. The Healthy People, Healthy Alaskans 2010 goal is 17%, so we're very close to that. The disturbing part is that we haven't had data since 2003, and nationally we're seeing that trend starting to go back up a little bit with adolescents, and we hope that that's not what's happening in our state, but we suspect that it probably is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You said that we don't have data. Does that mean that we're not tracking it, or we just haven't gotten it back yet?
We don't have it. Those data are collected in a survey called the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, and it has an active parental consent component to it and that makes it a little difficult to make sure we get enough parental consent. So we've been working to find different ways to get incentives so that we can get the consents back so that we can survey the students.
I thought we changed that. Didn't we?
Not yet. That's another discussion that we could have. But if you look at adult smoking, you can see that really since the last 10 years, the rates have pretty much flattened. I mean, they're going down, but they've flattened out, and we're fairly, you know, we're not really close to our goal of 14%. But again, in Alaska, smoking in our overall population is, you know, close to the national, but one of the areas that we really see disparities is in our Alaska Native population. They have about twice the smoking rate. Then we look at adolescent overweight, and again, this is from the same survey, the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. We have only one data point really in Alaska where we looked at this question, and that is there was about 27% of our students were overweight or at risk for overweight. If we look at adults, you can see that the trend for the last 10 years is climbing. And nationally, it doesn't look to be even flattening out. It looks to be going still up. And, you know, you look at that statistic, 63% of our population is either overweight or obese. And that statistic alone will tell you that there's going to be impact on our healthcare system in multiple areas. So how are we addressing this, all these issues? Well,
one of the things that you look at is, we've talked about these are choices, so it really kind of boils down to one question. How do you get people to change behaviors that they have developed over a lifetime? It's a really difficult thing. And one of the ways that we're trying to do this, and this is a nationally evidence-based approach, is to identify the places where unhealthy behaviors both occur and can be impacted, while recognizing the role of individual choice. And I think Jerry, you know, brought that point around too. We can only do so much, and then we really have to, you know, provide people with the tools and the resources, but they're the ones that have to make the choices. So we look at about, there's four settings that really, where we can have some impact in terms of looking at what we're doing, particularly in our section: the community, the work site, the schools, and healthcare setting. And these are some of the following are some of the initiatives that we have underway in our section of chronic disease. And the first one is the formation of the section of chronic disease. And we really appreciate our commissioner and our director about 2 years ago having the forethought to really pull all the programs and risk factors for chronic disease into one section so that there could be some opportunity for integration. The other things we have underway, and I'll talk more about these as we go through, looking at employee health improvement, school wellness initiative, the community-based prevention, disease management, and chronic disease self-management. As I mentioned, we are now a new section. We've been a section for about a year now. And again, one of the opportunities was to bring together all these different programs, the diabetes, cancer, arthritis, obesity, tobacco, heart disease and stroke, all of these different programs under one umbrella, if you will, and really start to look at how those programs could collaborate and really utilize their resources across programs, because oftentimes the same audience that you're trying to do something for with obesity prevention is certainly going to impact what the diabetes folks are doing. So we've been really working hard to integrate our activities so that we aren't duplicating efforts and that we're really getting more bang for our buck. So I just wanted to let you know some of the things that we have underway. And I'll also mention that most of our programs in our sections we're mostly funded by federal programs from CDC. Most of our dollars are federal dollars, not really general fund dollars. We have some, but mostly it is federal funding. This is an employee health improvement, and we're doing a pilot project with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. They have rolled out this whole project with some of their insurers looking at how to improve health promotion at the work site. And this is an area that we're very much interested in. So we've partnered with them to look at four different small businesses around Alaska, and then we have four what we're calling kind of control places where we're not being involved. And we're working with them to help them understand how to come up with a set of best practices for small businesses in Alaska to ensure that they could do health promotion in an effective and fiscally manageable way, because that's one of the things that's hard at this level, is that they would like to do things, but how do you do that when they don't have a lot of money? So that's underway now, and we're hoping within probably the next 6 months to have a handbook that we'll be able to provide small businesses around the state with kind of a how-to guide and what works in Alaska in terms of employee wellness. So we're pretty excited about that, and it's been a good partnership with Blue Cross.
Tammy, now, is that in conjunction with the state employees? I mean, because they are managing the state
right.
health program. Is this separate from that?
It is separate. We've been working with them before that switched over. We're mostly working with them with very small businesses under 200 employees. And most three of the businesses are under 100 employees, so they're small businesses. But we're not doing anything specifically at this point with the state employees. The next area or setting is school, and we have several things going on. As I think most of you know, our young people are our future, and as Jerry said, I think Roberta said too, we want to be nice to our children so they will take care of us. But for that to happen, we have to have healthy children, and I'm sure most of you know that we're not seeing that. I mean, we're seeing kids really today going down a lifestyle that's really not conducive for longevity and health.
Isn't this the first generation that is not expected to live as long as their parents?
That's my ending slide. But if you look at some of the things that are exciting, I've been in this area for a long time, and actually I started out in school health and have been waiting for things to kind of come around so that we would get some motivation from people in the education and that sort of thing. Now we've partnered with our colleagues in the Department of Education, and there's a whole federal legislation came out a couple years ago mandating that in the WIC reauthorization that schools needed to develop wellness policies by the summer of 06. So we have been working diligently with our partners at Department of Ed in producing. We've produced an Alaska Wellness Toolkit. We just had a Wellness Institute about a week and a half ago, and it was just great. It was very well attended. We had over 65 participants. And so we're really making some inroads into trying to find ways that we can work with schools to increase their ability to offer programs and that sort of thing in their schools.
Now, is that going to be, is there going to be funds to help the schools do that? Or because lots of times if they aren't doing PE, then if they need to, well, then that means they need another teacher. And
right. With this this mandate, there's no funding specifically, and so that's why we see some school districts just taking the very bare bones that we worked with the Alaska Association of School Boards put together a sample policy. Some school districts have just said, okay, here's a policy, we have it on the books, we've met the requirement. Other school districts have really fully embraced this and are using it as an opportunity to catapult some of the efforts that have been underway. An example, in Anchorage, they've made huge strides this year to change out their vending machines, taking out a lot of the soda and that sort of thing. And just a side note, my son's a senior at Diamond, and he came home a couple weeks after school started, and he said, I need to ask you a question. I said, okay. He said, did you have anything to do with there's no more good stuff in our vending machine? I said, well, you don't even drink soda. He said, yeah, but my friends do. And he said, they know you. And I said, well, I would like to think I single-handedly did it, but no. But I had a part in it. So it's exciting to see that. And also Matsu has done that, Kodiak, several of the school districts around the state, and we're offering consultation to them through our department and through the Department of Ed. We do have some small pots of money from the USDA for what we call the Team Nutrition Grant that schools have applied for that want to really, do some additional kinds of things, but there's not a lot of money with it. But we're excited because this is the first time we've seen something that gives us an opportunity to really make some inroads. So we're taking it and moving it forward. So I think there are a lot of things that are really going on with our schools. And then, of course, trying to get support for the Youth Risk Behavior Survey because, as we know, we need to have our data so that we can really provide really strong foundational arguments for what we're doing and to see if things are making a difference. And then another area is the community. We have several community-based prevention programs, mostly with our tobacco program because that's where we have the most amount of funding. We fund about 18 community-based programs for prevention and about 4 different cessation programs. And so that is really a great opportunity. We also are doing a collaborative effort right now to look at a large school community effort to really launch some real specific initiatives around tobacco prevention in rural Alaska. And we're hoping that out of that we'll also kind of be able to utilize some of the other more broad comprehensive health education initiatives as well.
Representative Gardner?
The money that's used for these tobacco initiatives, is that from the tobacco settlement money?
Yes, it is.
And the fact that the state has used some of those monies for other unrelated things, is that impacting your ability to move forward with programs, or do you feel like these specific things are adequately funded?
Well, I think that, we have a very good base right now, and I think as we look to the future, it looks like we're going to get increased funding, and we always, of course, would like more funding, there's no question, but we also want to be very judicious in how we're spending the money. We want to make sure that the things that we're doing really are having an impact and that they're evaluated and that, you know, we're not just putting money out there just because we have more money. So I think we're at the point where we're really keeping up with what we can do and what we can offer and make sure that it's good quality work and that the money so far has been very helpful. We would obviously like more, but I think we're doing they're doing a good job with what they have right now.
Thank you.
What I'd really like, I'll just set aside, it would be great if we had an opportunity to use some of that money in a little broader sense, you know, for other kinds of chronic diseases rather than just, you know, so specific to tobacco, as some states have done.
Representative Sisson?
Yes, and Madam Chair, I think as you and others have mentioned, at the seat of a lot of these habitual choices is the use of alcohol, and it would be interesting to know just exactly what part, have some inkling of what part drinking and smoking has, and in prevention dollars, when you only focus on one part of the problem and not the whole array, you really lose some of the core. The core issues, and all of these things are really responding to other conditions that people are experiencing. They smoke, they drink, they do a lot of things because of that. That is a choice they make in dealing with the pressures they're dealing with in their lives.
Mm-hmm. I think you're correct. Representative Gardner.
Right. Not to belabor the point, but I was struck by your comment. You would use it more broadly if allowed. What does that mean?
Oh, well, probably I've not allowed. But
what's the impediment to using it more broadly?
Well, there's not enough to do the broader thing because right now with what we have and the focus with where we are at with tobacco, you know, that is it's meeting that need. Probably what I needed to say was it would be great if we had other opportunities to expand our funding so that we could do some of these community-based projects in other areas, like with obesity prevention and some of those things. We don't have that kind of flexibility in our other programs that we have in tobacco. So that's probably what I meant more specifically.
Okay. I'm just trying to understand if the state's use of the tobacco settlement money is adversely impacting your ability to do what the settlement monies were designed for.
I think that right now, you know, they're being used in a really functional, judicious way. As always, there's a level of funding we'd like to get to, and I think we're approaching that in tobacco. I guess I was just really commenting that it would be nice to have that kind of flexibility with some other funding streams to be able to do the kind of things that we do in tobacco to address some of these other issues.
Thank you.
And then the last thing I just want to talk about are another initiative underway that we're partnering with Jerry with the Division of Medicaid and also Healthcare Services is we've just started to really look at what we can do around disease management. And if you look at this definition in your handout of what disease management is, it's a system of coordinated healthcare interventions and communications for populations with conditions in which patient self-care efforts are significant. It supports the provider-patient relationship and the plan of care, emphasizes prevention utilizing evidence-based practice guidelines and patient empowerment strategies, and evaluates clinical, humanistic, and economic outcomes. That's a whole lot of real fancy words to say that it's a system that really is designed to intervene at the patient level to help them really manage their own disease rather than be so managed by what the physician is saying, but help them to understand how to take efforts to impact their own health. And I'm not sure how familiar all of you are with disease management. It's been around for probably about 8-10 years now, but it's really starting to pick up steam, and there are lots of states and different Medicaid programs looking at and utilizing disease management as a way to not only contain costs, but also really, I think that it's really important to improve the quality of the healthcare outcomes. So we are just my section, and we have a person dedicated to this with healthcare services to look at how this might look in our state. So we'll be coming back and having further discussions, right, Jerry, as we proceed. But we're very excited to look at what the potential possibilities could be.
How many are in your area? There's just two of you?
In my section?
Yeah.
There is actually about 45 people. Most of the staff is in Anchorage, and then some of the other staff are in Juneau. We have about 10 or 12 programs, depending on how you break them out.
And are all your programs scientifically, I mean, you know, every one of them, are they scientifically based so that we know that they do what they're going to do?
Yes. I mean, like I said, most of our programs are funded from CDC, so we have to apply for funding, meet all the criteria, you know, in terms of what our grants we're doing and those sorts of things and, you know, the data that we collect. So, yes. And we have a website, so you could, if you go into the Division of Public Health, you can click on our website and see all the different programs and then a lot of the different publications and things that we're doing.
Okay. Representative Sisson, you had a question?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my my question is disease management. Disease is, in fact, and chronic disease is, in fact, the giant in the state health budget. I think that everybody is aware of that. And there are many steps that get one to chronic disease.
Mm-hmm.
And this list looks like it's one part of the important component of things that needs to be in place, certainly with disease management. Is it not also a good way to deal with preventing chronic disease?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, on the continuum, we would like to see, if you look at healthcare dollar spending, and I think Brian talked about this in his, Brian Saylor, in one of his talks, the cause of most of our chronic or our healthcare expenditures are related to lifestyle choices and issues, and it's like 58-60%. The amount of money that we spend in our medical system is like less than 1% to address prevention and those kind of issues, but we spend 90-some percent on the after treatment. And really, disease management, what it's trying to do and what we hope that it will accomplish here, because we're looking at it with our Medicaid system, is these are already folks that, you know, have gone past that stage of, you know, prevention, but now we'd like to, in the secondary, tertiary care arena, try to make a difference in their quality of life, and also when you look at things like diabetes, you know, pushing out, you know, kidney failure, dialysis, all of those sorts of things that really add up to cost. So disease management is one component of that, but, you know, as a person who's spent most of their life in prevention, that's where my heart and where I would love to see more effort. I think the problem is, or the hard thing to sell with prevention is when you have, like if you're selling, if you're trying to talk about infectious diseases, you can talk about, okay, we'll vaccinate this many people and we'll prevent this many diseases. When you talk about prevention with chronic diseases and these sorts of things, it's really hard for people to understand because you can't quantify what's not going to happen. You know, it's hard to sell what's not going to happen. We intuitively, we have lots of information, but I think prevention is hard, and I think that's our job is to really figure out how we better market what we do and how we can get that across to legislators, our communities, our healthcare providers, because really, that's where it's got to happen. I mean, there's only so much we can do with treatment and drugs and bringing people to that point, but we have to back up way before the lemmings are going over the edge, because it's just going to continue.
Tammy, do you know early on in the presentation it said that chronic disease accounts for about 75% of health care in the United States. Do you know how much it is in Alaska?
We don't have an exact cost, but I would say it's pretty close to probably the national, wouldn't you, Jerry? Maybe a little bit higher.
you know, just the fact that is possible, that we're even higher, it tells me we have to start looking at prevention, because we cannot keep, right now this 75% is costing the state of Alaska so much money. That's going to grow tremendously, and if we don't start putting some bucks in the areas of prevention, we're going to have to change from that 1%.
Right.
We have to.
We're going to have to pay. We're going to pay the piper one way or the other. So, you know, my preference would be to have some upstream kinds of efforts. I'll just finish up real quickly. And then the last piece under that is self-management. And it's really a component of disease management. I kind of think of disease management as the 50,000 view working with the healthcare system. And then self-management is really the on-the-ground, the patient, what they're actually doing for themselves. And we brought Kate Lorig up from Stanford last January. She is a nationally known she's a professor there and has developed this whole model of chronic disease self-management. And we brought in folks from all around, several of the FQHCs, the federally qualified health centers, and other community health care centers, trained providers and community members in this self-management course. It's a six-week course, and we've had an incredible response from folks who have taken it back to their communities. And it really, what it is it teaches people about how to eat right, how to manage stress, exercise, making sure they're taking their medications, all the things that go into being able to manage your own disease, whether it's arthritis, diabetes, or whatever the chronic disease is. So those are just some of the things that we have going on right now. But there's much work that remains, and some of the things that we want to do is we really need to work more with our communities, and again, providing communities with prevention information and the tools to help them manage their own health and their health care efforts. We want to work more closely with our health care providers and continue our partnering with schools to promote healthy lifestyles among our youth. And if we do nothing besides health care costs continuing to rise, I'll leave you with a quote Peggy talked about. The youth of today may on average live less healthy and possibly even shorter lives than their parents. And is that the legacy that we want to leave to the next generation? So thank you so very much for the opportunity to come and speak with you, and I would certainly be happy to answer any questions. Senator Davis, do you have any questions?
I don't have a question.
Okay.
More or less a comment. Most of your money is coming from the federal government, along with the tobacco settlement monies and other things that you have. What percentage did you say you were getting from the state? You know, many of the things that we are looking at and we're trying to make sure that we have these things in our state, I was just glad to see these here. There are many things that we could be sticking dollars into your program to carry out some of the initiatives that we want to develop. You've already started on.
I would say it's probably maybe 5 to 10% of our total section budget is general funds.
Very, we need to look at it.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent idea. Representative Sisman?
Yes, first to that point, certainly in fundraising, what you find out is the people who usually give you the most money are the people who've already invested in you. And I think that is based on human characteristic, that when you invest in something, you're willing to put more time into it. And if the state doesn't invest more money into the health of our state, we're not going to follow through and actually really do what is necessary. I think we need to, as a state, and I think that Senator Davis is right on point there, that until we start thinking of health as more important in our state, we won't invest in it, and much to our peril. And the last, and thank you very, very much for that presentation. I did make a copy of the last health caucus, which was on the economics of health, and Brian Saylor did make a presentation with Dr. Aaron Wolf on how to bring down some of the costs through prevention. We had a number of other people spoke as well, and so there's the PowerPoint has some of the comments that were made and all of the backup material that they gave us. So
I'll pass it out to the committee and also anyone else in the audience who would like a copy. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you very much. And also I brought, it was a NSNBC.com. They have a site, and this was something that was in Newsweek magazine, and I've got that at the door also if anybody wants to pick it up. And the title of it is it The Monster at Our Door, Uncontrolled Health Spending Poses Ugly Choices, Raise Taxes, Gut Other Programs, or Run Ever Larger and Dangerous Deficits. So I brought that too. We have to do something. And that brings us back around to, for us as a state and our charge for the HEF committee and the committee of 10 that went to Denver and took the, or at least went through the conference of spending health care dollars wisely. And so we have one more meeting in October. Becky, are you still on, Becky?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Do we have a title for or a subject for next time?
No, I don't. I don't have it down.
Okay. Commissioner, do you know what we're going to go over next time?
Thank you, Madam Chair. What we were going to look at is kind of framing everything that we've done, looking at access, quality, and cost of care. Since that meeting at this point, I think it's scheduled the 25th or around about there of October, which is during AFN, and since we talked about doing something in November, it might make sense to bump that meeting into early November.
November is going to be a bad time.
Well, I do have one scheduled anyway because I knew that we wouldn't be able to get it all done in one meeting. And so I was planning on that meeting plus a meeting in November, like November 8th or 9th. I can't remember what I was looking at. I might have it on my calendar even. Let me look here.
I wonder, if, Madam Chair, if it would be possible that we might make that a three-hour meeting instead of a two-hour and then do kind of both pieces at once.
Okay. Let me look here.
What was the date?
Rep. Wilson, that meeting is on the 9th.
The 9th. Okay. Thank you. I'm looking on my calendar and I'm trying. Okay. Okay. Well, we could skip maybe. If we do, I think we need a four-hour meeting.
That sounds great. Yeah.
The Democratic offices are tentatively scheduled 8th through the 10th after the election in November. So
8th through the 10th.
Well, we don't know.
Are we speaking to November now?
Well, the one that we had planned in October, which was the 25th of October, and I had planned to have that one in Juneau because I was going to be coming back from somewhere, and so I figured we'll have that one in Juneau. When is AFN?
Madam Chair, it's that same week of October.
That whole week?
Right, and Thursday is the day when the state traditionally goes and speaks at AFN. So trying, as you know, to get from Juneau to Fairbanks is a challenge. You can't do it in one day.
Yeah.
But we'd have to leave on Wednesday. So, but we'll work with whatever works for you, and it may be something we can do offline.
I'm trying to think if we could change it.
How about how it in Fairbanks?
Well, would we able
to?
Well, I'm trying to think of the cost. And so, you know, I've been coming to Anchorage because it's easier for one person to come than you guys all go to Juneau, you know.
Some of us have campaigns, too. We might not leave town.
Oh, there is.
Oh, that's right.
That's
right.
That's a priority.
Yeah.
No point working on this if I'm not going to be here next year.
Right. Well, maybe it would be best, let's think about skipping it, but then if we're going to skip it, we almost have to.
Why are we skipping it? October's meeting? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
October? Why are we skipping it?
Well, because it was the last and because some of them wanted to go to be working on their campaign that week.
Oh, but you weren't said not have the meeting at all. You were saying you didn't want to go to Juneau.
I won't go to town.
I misunderstood.
Quite honestly, we can have it anywhere because we can all phone in.
Yeah. Well, I think it's going to be a... You guys are going to be traveling that day, or will you already be there?
We can... We'll adjust whatever we need to, Madam Chair. It may just mean that we're not able to participate in AFN, some of us, on that Thursday. So we'll do what we need to make it work for the committee. But it was just a brainstorm that if we're going to do November anyway, just a couple weeks after that meeting, maybe it would make sense to make that one longer. But if that doesn't work, that's fine.
Madam Chair, AFN has a schedule out already, right? You are saying that particular Thursday you're to present to them that day? You know the time?
I don't know the time, no. No, we don't know yet.
Because it might not interfere at all. She's going to be here. You're going to present in Anchorage, right? This is where the convention is held here. Mm-hmm. AFN is here.
Oh, yeah, it is. This year is here.
Right. And the,
I don't see that as a problem. I see that as a benefit.
Okay, so we're going to... Okay.
So if the meeting is scheduled for Juneau... But we have most folks here,
then probably I would have to just change my schedule. Since no one else can change theirs, I might be able to I might be able to do that.
Are we at 8:30 on the 26th?
We had changed it to 9, but I think if we're going to be in Anchorage, we better say 8, and let's do it from 8 to 11, because these last two meetings, we're going to have to make a lot of decisions, and the next meeting is more almost like a work committee meeting, so that we, because we're going to have to hash through a lot of things. We're going to have to, you know, what I'd like to do is everyone that's presented, what I'd like is if you go over your programs that you have and look at the missions and measures that the legislature has in your already, you already have to have the answers to that, the missions and measures. If we can have the answers to some of that, so as we're looking at it, we can look at a program and say, okay, this program, is it meeting the mission that it was set out to meet? And then look at whether it is or not. Because we have to make that. I just think it's we're better off looking at the programs and deciding what to do as a group rather than having... And have facts in front of us rather than having a legislature that says, oh, we don't need to do this, and so they make those kind of decisions. I think we need to come up with some recommendations so that they have something to go by. And so I think we really need to look at each program individually and see what's working and what maybe needs to either be improved or switched around and make that a prevention program. Those type of things, because I think we really have to look at that and think about that. So that's kind of where I'm headed for the next meeting as far as what we're actually going to do. And that's going to take some serious time to discuss and really have some time doing that. So let's go ahead and have it in Anchorage. And I will... We can all, with that in mind, know what our goals are for next time. And then just be prepared to have those answers of what's the missions and what is the mission of your program. If it doesn't have a mission and measure, then what is the goal? And over the years that it's been in the process, have we seen a difference? Is there, you know... Because we've really got to get down to the nitty-gritty with some of this stuff. So that's what I would like to have all of us looking at next time. And if anybody has as you get data pulled together or anything, if you'd like to send it to my office, I can make sure it gets to all the members before the next meeting. It'd be nice. Because I think this is stuff that we have to review ahead of time and so that we know what we're talking about at the meeting. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Wednesday, October 25th. And knowing that some of us may have to call in, I will make an effort to make sure I'm here. And, you know, depending on where you're at, I don't know how that's going to work, but it sounds like it's best if it's in Anchorage. So.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Could I just make this one comment? 8 o'clock might be a good time to have it, but it might not be a good time. And so maybe we shouldn't say exactly what time it's going to meet, because I'm hearing that the department has got to be at AFN at some particular time. They probably don't know the same day that we're meeting?
No, it's the next day.
It's the next day. Oh, okay, so it's not a problem. Okay.
Madam Chair, sort of to that point, however, having a meeting at 8 o'clock really mandates that people have been here the night before. And so it means somebody has to stay in a hotel bookhouse that comes, and that maybe having it a little later so that people have a chance to get here from Juneau might be, I mean, and I don't know. They know better than we do, but I think that might be.
Is there a plane that can get, what is the earliest you can get here from Juneau?
9:30,
so if we had it 10 o'clock till 1, maybe, would that be better?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Bring and then can you get back to Juneau on that same day?
Yep. You can get it back.
Okay, let's do that then. So, and if there's any changes in that, we can email and let you know. So we're looking then at
10 to 1
on the 25th of October. All right. Fine. Great. And without further ado, I guess we'll gavel out.
Thank you, Madam Chair.